You're listening to The Recap, first broadcast on the 22nd of August 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello, I'm Ben Rylan and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programs broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House and The Monocle Daily. Coming up on the show, on Wednesday, Germany's parliament voted overwhelmingly in favour of the latest bailout for Greece. Following the vote, we heard from our contributors about what it means for the debt-saddled country.
Logically, it seems to me that if the euro is going to staggle from crisis to crisis, which is an unsatisfactory situation for most members, then maybe we do, or they need to think about full political union and get on with it and have done with it.
Then we turn to the bright lights of Belgrade. Our correspondent there explains how the Serbian city has its eyes on becoming a big film production capital.
It's been a case of wanting to do a bit of positive international PR here, making sure that people know that the skills are available there, the production facilities are available, and, you know, as Serbia faces more towards the European Union, it's hoping that international film productions will face more towards Serbia.
And later in the show, our man in Madrid visits a gorgeously designed loft in the Spanish capital to see how its owners manage their classically styled leather goods brand from within their home on their own terms. All that and much more coming up in the next half hour, right here on The Recap, with me, Ben Rylan. It's been a busy news week, and one story we've been following across our programming has been the deadly bomb explosion near the Erawan Shrine in central Bangkok on Monday. The death toll remains at 20, with many more injured. On Monday's edition of the Monocle Daily, with details still emerging regarding the evolving situation, Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds spoke with Yukaku Ono, a journalist with Nikkei who was on the ground in the Thai capital.
We had this blast last night at 7 p.m. local time, and as far as we have confirmed, it's like 19 people dead and 117 injured. And of the 19 people who has been killed, four have been confirmed as foreigners, with Chinese and Filipinos, and others are unidentified.
It's about, I think I'm right in saying, 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning where you are now. So Thailand has had all evening to digest this so far. Has the government or any media made any suggestions at all about who might be responsible for this?
No official sources have claimed responsibility at this moment, but as far as I'm concerned and as far as the media is concerned, we see this as terrorism concerning political issues. And some official sources have said, for example, Defense Minister just gave an interview to local TV saying that this could be a terrorism to destroy tourism and economy of the country.
Well, what can we learn from exactly where the attack took place? Tell us about the Erawan Shrine. What's its significance and what might we glean from that being the target?
Erawan Shrine is a Hindu shrine in Bangkok, and while people might see that this could be related to religious conflicts in the southern Thailand area where there are actually insurgencies involving religious issues, but in this case we see this as a political issue, as this Erawan Shrine, this is more like a tourism attraction than a religious attraction, and we see many tourists and of course locals worshipping this shrine, which has this four-faced Brahma. We call this is a statue that is represents the Hindu creation god. And the location of this shrine is just on the doorstep of the National Police headquarters. And we've seen actually anti-government protests around here that just block this intersection. And we see some political developments often, once in a while, around this area.
You mentioned the conflict in the south of Thailand, which has been rumbling on for years and years and years. Does it have much history of spreading to Bangkok? Is this a completely new thing for the capital?
No, as I just mentioned, the Erawan Shrine has been kind of a target for these kind of terrorism, whether it's political or religious or not. And there has been many people that have some suspected connections with the South and religious issues, but in most cases, it's just turned out to be political. For example, in 2011, when the government protesters were there, it was just to discredit the government, which was then led by the Thaksin regime.
That was Yukaku Ono there, Bangkok correspondent with Nick Hay, speaking with Andrew Muller and Dominic Reynolds on Monday's edition of The Monocle Daily. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Another story that's made headlines this week has been an important vote regarding the future of Greece. In Germany, lawmakers voted on a controversial third multi-billion euro rescue package for the debt-ridden eurozone peer. Before this parliamentary vote took place, Georgina Godwin heard from Henning Meyer, editor-in-chief of Social Europe, to see how the story has been covered in the German press and to hear about German public opinion.
Overall, I think the passing of the package is not in any doubt. But there is a lot of sort of disenchantment about the way it was handled.
And does that reflect public opinion too?
I think so. Yeah, I mean, the package itself has got a positive and negative sides, right? I mean, the Grexit discussion now finally is put to rest, and given the pressure of the IMF, you even talk about debt sustainability, you know, stretching maturities and reducing interest rates. So that's definitely going to be good for Greece, but. The way all of this has been handled, you know, how democracy in Greece has been treated and how the interests or perceived interests of one people were put off against the interests of another people, that certainly has scarred a lot of the political discussion.
Now, the IMF, though, isn't due to make a decision till October.
No, that's right. But it basically said that if there is no sort of dealing with the debt overhang for Greece in a sustainable fashion, they won't be on board at all. Mm. And, you know, having the IMF on board, especially for German conservatives, has been one of the key ingredients. So in that sense, you know, it puts the pressure on to deal with the sustainability of the debt market, which is absolutely necessary, by the way, as well. So,
I mean, Merkel keeps talking about having room to manoeuvre. What will they do with that room?
Well, basically, she basically said there won't be a haircut, but what there will be, and she indicated it yesterday and in an interview in a German television over the weekend, it's basically they can stretch maturities, reduce interest rates. Effectively, it's not de facto a haircut, but it's a debt management tool nevertheless.
Mm. Now, of course, it's not only the German press that's talking about this, it's all over the papers here too. And I'm particularly interested in this piece in The Guardian, which talks about one of the rebels, that's Klaus-Peter Wilsch, a CDU rebel, and what he's saying. He says that it's far from clear what MPs will be voting on. He doesn't even know really what's on the table, that they've been given the information far too late, they've all been recalled back from holiday, they've been trying to read thousands of words on PDF formats, which they can't really do in their EasyJet seats if they're anything like David Cameron, and he says he's very confused.
Well, basically, they vote on the package, and the package involves different stages. And you know whether a new installment will be disbursed or not. That will again depend on the euro finance ministers. You know, it's a complicated process. But it's, as far as I can see, it's not much different to the first or the second package.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, he was complaining about exactly that on the first.
Exactly.
Yeah, so nothing new for him.
Interestingly, the Times picks up on it, but what they're talking about is whether she should stay or whether she should go, that of course she's always said that would be it at the end of her term, but that now she feels that if she did go, that she's become a prisoner of the euro, and with the multiple crises of the European Union and the migration problem and all the rest of it, that all her personal calculations have fallen by the wayside and that she must stay for the sake of the euro.
Yeah, but she's never actually said that she wouldn't run again, and now the indication is that she actually will. I mean, if you look at the discussion in the SPD, her coalition partners, the second big party in Germany, there was recently even a discussion whether the party should actually field a candidate that is called a chancellor candidate, given that there is at the moment so little likelihood that she will lose an election.
Yeah.
So even though her problems are mounting, because the kind of politics she practices is basically pushing things off and kicking it into the long grass.
Yeah.
So at some point it comes back to haunt you, but she's been doing well with it for 10 years now.
She certainly has. Is there much split within the German media of how it's been covered?
Well, there are now sort of pockets evolving and developing in the German media landscape where there is a more critical view of this. I mean, there was a lot of discussion about the failings of Greece and so on and so forth, and too little, in my personal view, about the failings of the so-called rescue packages and the politics leading up to this situation. Mm-hmm. But this is diversifying now a bit more.
Yeah. What about your own organ, Social Europe? How are you covering it?
Well, we've been very critical of the rescue packages because the way, you know, Greece was treated politically, the way the rescue packages basically haven't dealt with the debt sustainability issue at all because of the way it has basically constrained growth, and you need economic growth in order to grow out of a debt situation of that magnitude. So basically the rescue policies so far have been misguided. Mm-hmm. And there still is a lack of growth impulses. At least the debt sustainability issue is now being, as I said, put on the agenda by the IMF. But the policy direction over the last 5 years has been badly botched, in my views.
That was Georgina Godwin there with Henning Meyer in a highlight from Wednesday's edition of The Globalist. Well, of course, we just heard from Henning Meyer, who explained public opinion preceding the big bailout vote in Germany's parliament. That third bailout was indeed approved by German lawmakers on Wednesday. The Bundestag voted convincingly in favour of the deal, 453 yes to 113 no, while 18 abstained, although 47 largely conservative MPs decided not to put themselves in a position to defy the Chancellor, Angela Merkel, and declined to turn up. On Wednesday's edition of Midori House, Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke about this with Ivor Gaber from Sussex University and Martin Sanbu, an economics writer at the Financial Times.
It seems to me that public opinion might well say either we're done with it, it's not working, or look, we've got to go the whole hog. I mean, when the euro was being formed, there were debates that you cannot have effective monetary union without full political union. And logically, it seems to me that if the euro is going to staggle from crisis to crisis, which is an unsatisfactory situation for most members, then maybe we do, or they need to think about full political union and get on with it and have done with it.
If I can break in there, because I'm in a very small minority that thinks this is incorrect. Most people believe that you can't have a monetary union, a single currency, unless you also have budget transfers and a political union
and
to control
union.
Fiscal union, exactly. So money coming from Germany and the other creditor states to the periphery.
This is the idea that Europe would basically need to be the United States.
That's the idea. Yeah. You hear that a lot, and you hear it especially from pretty much all the establishment politicians in the Eurozone, the centre-left and the centre-right, and it's the intellectual premise for the entire policy. It's got a kicking and screaming, that's where they've been going. Now, I think, I argue this in my book, that that's incorrect as a matter of analysis. You can have successful monetary union without fiscal transfers and a political union. If that's right, then it's very dangerous to make policy on the basis of an idea that's, one, incorrect, and second, gives the people a choice between two options they hate.
I hate to ask you a question which I know you'll know the answer to, because I was told that barristers never ask questions that they think the witness will know the answer to. But I can't think of any examples of successful monetary unions without political union. I had a brief experience of living in East Africa when the failed East African monetary union was taking place. I would be very interested to know what examples you're thinking of where there has been a successful monetary union without political union.
Well, the word political union is ambiguous and people use it in a lot of different senses. Let's just talk about fiscal union, so budget transfers from richer to poorer states. There's a good case to make that for about 150 years, the US was a successful monetary union without a fiscal union. There was no federal income tax. There were no transfers really between states until 1913 was a federal income tax. In 1936, the federal budget was still about 5% of GDP, and that was with the New Deal in full swing. So, that's one example.
Anything more up to date?
Oh, no, I don't think there's much up to date. No, I think in that sense, it's a very singular experiment. There is the Belgian-Luxembourg monetary union that worked well until it was absorbed into the euro, but I don't know how much you want to generalise from that.
Luxembourg's not exactly a major economic power. I do think that there is this problem that, as Andrew was suggesting, it's neither one thing nor t'other at the moment, that the Eurozone is trapped between these two difficulties, and it's difficult. If it's not Greece next time, who will it be? Will it be Bulgaria or Romania, if and when they join? I do think there's a real problem, although personally, I would be a great enthusiast for an ever closer union with Britain, ho, 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 a part of it.
That was Andrew Muller with Ivor Gaber and Martin Sanbu on Wednesday's edition of Midori House.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here at Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. All this week on Monocle 24, we have, of course, been looking at our latest entrepreneurs-themed issue of Monocle magazine. On Thursday, we heard from our correspondent Liam Aldous, who paid a visit to a beautiful loft in Madrid, converted into both home and workshop by a couple of spirited leather goods makers. The beautifully shot report can be found in this month's design pages, showing how working from home requires striking the right balance between work and play. The couple, David Iglesias Resina and Melina Carranza Maciel, talk to Liam about how they manage their classically styled leather goods brand Officio Studio from within their home and on their own terms.
In Madrid's burgeoning design district El Barrio de las Letras, on the third floor of an old residential building, a Spanish-Mexican husband and wife team are busy cutting fine leather straps and soldering small iron clasps. Their beautifully decorated workshop is also their home, which not only reflects their small leather goods brand Oficio Studio, but also a desire for a slower, less complicated lifestyle.
Well, we were looking for a place for working without people. I mean, I had a small leather shop inside of that big pie shop, but all the time was the phone ringing, people coming in, coming out. We were looking for a place for working by order, by appointment, everything, just like for slowing down.
The long-abandoned loft was discovered by chance, perched high above David's small bicycle shop and workshop. The decision to move into the loft would change their lives, both personally and professionally. In the immediate term, however, the dilapidated space also required a lot of elbow grease.
It was really terrifying. Was destroyed, was like a horror movie.
The bathroom and the kitchen is completely new, and we had to reinforce the ceilings, oiling the wooden floors, and also we're like glass missing from the windows. But basically, as I would say, cleaning, clean, clean, clean for months and months. Well, we spend a lot of time here, really a lot of time. So it's always something to fix, something to paint, or something to make up. And also, sometimes we design our own furniture.
After just a few months, David decided to close his shop downstairs. But the couple make no apologies for downsizing, believing it has helped them to focus on doing what they love and concentrate on doing it well.
Is the line blurred between work and play?
Yeah, it's completely blurred. Normally on weekends we continue, like, there is a mix between working or doing stuff in the house or sometimes going out, but most of the time is doing stuff inside for Officio and for ourselves.
It's simple. If you have your mind in a lot of things, probably don't do nothing well. So I experienced myself, so I decide to focus in one. I choose Leatherworks.
Their brand Officio Studio has blossomed as a result, paying homage to the classic leather accessories of a bygone era. From the old carry bags of doctors to the school bags that were once the standard carryall in Spanish primary schools, there's also a beautiful selection of wallets, notebooks and even aprons. All are handmade to order at a very measured pace.
I think the space reflects our personality. I mean, We want that open space, bright space, because we want to reflect our lifestyle. You know, the way we think, we feel. We don't like to have bosses. We don't like to be in a rural place. So that's why we have a lot of plants. All the materials here are noble materials, no plastic, no chemic. So everything is for looking for a balance. That's what we want in our life.
It helps because our products reflect our state of mind, I think. It's very simple. I think we are doing things simple. I mean, the light, the place, the plants, all this relaxed situation or place help us to create and to work in a relaxed way. We work a lot, but the place helps.
That was David Iglesias Resina and Melina Carranza Maciel of Oficio Studio in Madrid, speaking to Monocle's correspondent Liam Aldous. This is The Recap on Monocle 24, and it's time now for a highlight from Tuesday's edition of The Briefing, and off to the bright lights of, well, not really Hollywood, but Belgrade. The Serbian city has its eyes on becoming a film production capital, with a 20% tax rebate offered as a dangling carrot for international productions. Pierce Brosnan and Kevin Costner have recently made good use of the incentive, recently wrapping shoots in the country. Serbia hopes to become an attractive destination for international film productions, joining the growing list of countries eager to attract Hollywood away from its Los Angeles backlots. Marcus Hippie spoke with Monocle's correspondent in Belgrade, Guy Delaunay.
Well, I mean, you've got a lot of skilled film professionals in Serbia. This is a hangover from Yugoslav times. There's actually a place in Belgrade called Filmski Grad, which is, you know, Film City, which had all these studios, massive sound stages, amazing film production facilities, which have really been withering in the years following the conflict which broke up Yugoslavia. However, all the skills, all the technicians, all the camera operators, directors even, are still here. And you see people on the streets of Belgrade all the time making films. On my road, Kralja Petra, I saw Pierce Brosnan filming November Man. I saw an Indian production team on the street the other day making a film as well. It's a very photogenic city. The skills are there. It's a bit of a no-brainer, really.
Exactly. You say that the skills are there and have been ever since the 70s and 80s or so. Do you think that international productions perhaps forgot about that country in recent years?
I think they probably did, and I think there was also an element of, you know, is this a safe place to go? Because when there's a war in your region, and when the Serbs certainly in many quarters were painted out as being the big villains of the Balkan conflicts, do you want to be connected with that country? So I think it's been a case of wanting to do a bit of positive international PR here, making sure that people know that the skills are available there, the production facilities are available. There's one Berlin-based outfit which is trying to revive Avala Film, which is part of Filmski Grad. And, you know, as Serbia faces more towards the European Union, it's hoping that international film productions will face more towards Serbia again. And of course, a tax rebate's a good way of prodding them in the right direction.
Exactly. Looking at it's not just, it feels like so many European countries currently are fighting to get international film productions brought to their respective countries and cities. Do you think Belgrade actually has a chance in this competition? And how would you sell Serbia to international filmmakers yourself?
Well, you know, Serbia, you can stand in for Russia. That's a big thing, because we all know that Moscow is one of the most expensive cities to film in the world, or one of the most expensive cities as an expat in the world. Well, Serbia's got Cyrillic script, just like Moscow. Slightly different Cyrillic, but to a casual viewer, you wouldn't really notice the difference. And that's why it was good to film November Man in Belgrade. It was partly set in Moscow, but all filmed in Serbia, because you've got the Cyrillic alphabet around. And, you know, the mixture of architecture is not entirely dissimilar. This is the whole thing. Any successful film city needs to be able to stand in for other places, and Belgrade, with its mix of Habsburg brutalist styles, it can certainly do that.
Well, we're approaching the end of the program now, but before we depart, let's hear a monologue from Friday's edition of The Globalist. Our Istanbul Bureau Chief Chris Lord is known to be fairly partial to a good piece of cheese, but you might be surprised to learn just how much politics there is behind the delicacy.
The fact that some were alarmed shows how right we were. A statement like that, coming out of an official newswire, would normally be attached to ramped up security measures, a tight new squeeze of corporation tax, or a diplomat being told to pack their bags. Not so for Nikos Kouyalis, Republic of Cyprus's agriculture minister, who is referring instead to something white, tasty, and that squeaks when you bite it. Halloumi, the Eastern Med's much-loved rubbery cheese, has become a fixture on the negotiating table between Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots. Talks for some sort of settlement plan to the territorial conflict that has divided them since 1974 and left vast swathes of the island out of bounds in the United Nations buffer zone have cautiously resumed on and off. But last year, when the Republic of Cyprus applied to the European Union for a protected designation of origin, a PDO status for halloumi, a dairy-based diplomatic debacle unfolded on a grand scale. A successful PDO application would mean that only halloumi made in the Republic of Cyprus, and according to a certain recipe, could carry the name. Turkish Cypriots were certainly cheesed off. Most of its exports currently go to Turkey in the Middle East. Here in Istanbul, we eat Cyprus's helim, which uses less cow's milk than the southern variety. A PDO, therefore, would prohibit northern Cyprus getting a similar protected status for its produce. Economic destruction was a somewhat hyperbolic prediction. All this seemed ready to derail negotiations between the two sides once again, before an unlikely consensus emerged. In July, Jean-Claude Juncker, basking in one of the finer moments of his tenure as president of the EU Commission, revealed that he'd managed to get both sides to agree over the halloumi question during a visit to the island. Both halloumi and helim will jointly enjoy PDO status. It may not be quite the Oslo Accords, but it's a step in the right direction. What a pleasant agreement like this needs now is a little outside interference. So, enter Britain, former colonial protector and the biggest market for halloumi outside of Cyprus. This week, British cheesemakers have challenged the EU's PDO, claiming that it'll stop them from selling their product. They could just give it a different name, of course, but squeak cheese doesn't have the same palatable punch. The response to this development from both sides of the island, however, has been fascinating. North and South are, somewhat miraculously, united by a common cause. Agriculture Minister Kouyalis has said that while the Cyprus PDO is pending, no one else can make a bid. There was certainly a sense that whether you call it halloumi or halim, the stuff is broadly ours. The Cyprus question remains a top priority. On the Turkish mainland, the island's division is a critical roadblock for Turkey to join the EU. More pressingly, and this little morsel can't have escaped the attention of Mr. Juncker, if Cyprus reunites, then a pipeline will carry gas from the Eastern Mediterranean's extensive gas fields to the EU via northern Cyprus to Turkey. As long as the island is divided, Turkey has vetoed any such pipeline, however lucrative it may be. The positive gains in this halloumi hullabaloo, therefore, have region-shaking implications. If Cyprus's settlement talks stay on track ahead of a May 2016 deadline, then it might not just be cheeses that are ripe for a rebrand. From Monocle in Istanbul, I'm Christopher Lord.
And that's it for this week's edition of The Recap. The show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli and edited by Sam Impey. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programs here on Monocle 24. But for now, from me, Ben Ryland, thank you for listening and goodbye.